Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
In the 16th and 17th centuries, sailing was crucial. It was a tool of warfare and empire, of conquest and discovery, and, of course, of basic travel. The dominant maritime forces of the time, Spain, Portugal, England and Holland, all had established extensive fleets for trade. Merchant ships carried art, textiles, currency and other precious goods, the most valuable of which was spice, to expand their territories and establish the first global trade routes. In heavy storms and on unfamiliar routes, through attack and piracy, as well as incomplete or incorrect maps, vessels were often lost, wrecked, and many of them are still being found. The most famous Tudor wreck is, of course, the Mary Rose, on display in a wonderful state-of-the-art museum in Portsmouth Historic Dockyard. But how about other wrecks from the period? Here to talk about just some of them is David Gibbons, maritime archaeologist and author of A History of the World in 12 Shipwrecks. His work as a diver has taken him across the globe, investigating some of the most fascinating wrecks in history. David, welcome to Not Just the Tudors.
Very pleased to be here. Thank you.
I am delighted to have a chance to talk to you, pick your brains about this fascinating subject. Can you tell me, first of all, what it means to work as a marine archaeologist? What can we learn from investigating a shipwreck in situ?
Well, shipwrecks are, first of all, unique types of archaeological site because they represent a single moment in time that you might call very high resolution sites, so that the artifacts you find have a very close association with each other. You can date them by that association, and they tell us about a particular event, which in a way is very familiar to us. We don't have to work very hard to understand what happened with a shipwreck. So in one sense, they're really easy sites to understand archaeologically, and they have this incredible power to tell us in great detail about that moment in time, and for that to be a springboard for looking at all of the other aspects of life, economic and otherwise, which are represented in the artifacts. So that's one aspect of shipwreck archaeology. The other one is the difficulty of actually accessing the sites and sort of realizing their potential. And that's all to do, of course, with challenges of work underwater, which can often be extremely difficult. And so as an archaeologist, you have this great adventure in finding shipwrecks and investigating the sites, but also the challenge of, for example, time constraints, because wrecks, even relatively shallow, often you can only spend half an hour or 40 minutes or an hour on them. And so all that time that archaeologists would normally have in a land site for contemplating and thinking about what they're looking at, you don't really have underwater. Everything is very intensive about shipwrecks. The archaeology and the history is very kind of intensive and focused. And so is investigation. So it's a kind of highly ratcheted up process. You then have to hope that all of those experiences you have while you're diving on wrecks and doing the work stays with you when you then spend those weeks and months sitting afterwards thinking about what it all means.
And does it matter very much where the ship goes down? Because one of the things that's always said about the Mary Rose is the fact that the silt of the Solent preserves the artifacts that's so important. So what does that mean for other wreck locations?
That's a very good point. You have ships generally in deeper water being better preserved as artifacts as a whole. You're more likely to get substantial hull preservation as you do with the Mary Rose. But one of the really fascinating aspects of my research, right from the very outset when I began diving as a student on wrecks in the Mediterranean, right the way through to the work that I'm mainly doing now, which is in fact off Cornwall, is that wrecks in very shallow water up against rocky coasts or sandy shorelines, in the most adverse of circumstances, exposed to westerlies from the Atlantic, huge gales and sea and seabed movement, can often contain pockets of extraordinary preservation. And several of the wrecks that I've been involved with recently off Western Cornwall are ships that are very, very badly smashed up and you don't find any hull remains. And there's very little obvious coherence in the spread of material. You know, you're looking at a shipwreck, but you can't talk about whether you're at one end of the ship or the other. But what you do get just through the circumstances of the seabed topography and sedimentation is pockets within those sites of extraordinary preservation in which you can have organic remains just as significant as those from the Mary Rose. So as so often in archaeology, nothing is really predictable and every wreck is worthy of the same attention because you never really know what you're likely to find. But there are many, many circumstances in which wrecks that seem to offer little potential with a bit of investigation do produce really significant discoveries.
That must be so exciting. Can we talk about the Santo Cristo di Castello? This is a merchant ship that was wrecked off the coast of England, as I understand it, on her maiden voyage in 1667. What do we know about the vessel and its journey before the wreck?
So the Santo Cristo di Castello, which is nicknamed the Mullion Pin Wreck, was wrecked in 1667 near Mullion on the west coast of the Lizard Peninsula. And the wreck was discovered in 1969 by a local diver, a Royal Naval officer called Peter McBride, who was snorkeling along the coast. This is very shallow. And he rounded a corner, this dramatic rocky coast, looked down, and there was cannon sticking out and a glitter on the seabed. And that glitter turned out to be thousands of clothing pins, which had come from Amsterdam. And these, of course, at that period were items of considerable value, all handmade. And so it got that nickname. And his research subsequently pinpointed its identity really as the Santo Cristo di Castello, which was a Genoese funded ship built in Amsterdam in 1665-66, very lavishly funded, built probably to the same standards, even in the same shipyards as the Dutch East Indiamen of the period. So a very grand vessel designed for the transport of goods from Amsterdam down to Spain and then into the Mediterranean and up to Italy. And of course, at that period, the Genoese were very big players in international trade. And they, in fact, had quite a lot of their vessels built in Amsterdam. So we know from the documentary records more and more about the ship. She was very well appointed. She had 48 guns, which, you know, makes her as big as a warship of the period. And we have to remember that at that time, 1667 was still the Anglo-Dutch War, and any merchantman going venturing out and onto the channel and beyond had to be armed because of the possibility of being attacked and taken as a prize. And then they had to also confront the pirates of the Barbary coast of North Africa. From our perspective, she would have looked very much like a warship, but she was in fact a merchant ship. And there's just amazingly rich site and rich history. The excavation produced a fantastic range of materials, including raw materials. There were lead ingots and copper ingots and a large consignment of iron, which had corroded and created a kind of granite hard mat over the site. And beneath that, a lot of very fine artifacts were preserved, comprising both other types of cargo materials and also shipboard equipment and personal belongings. And that evidence has been complemented by some fascinating documentary evidence from the National Archives as a result of the fact that another ship from Amsterdam built at the same time, you could almost call her a sister ship, called the Abraham Sacrifice, had left Amsterdam also that summer in 1667, but she had in fact been captured by the English and taken as a prize. And as a result of that, all of her papers have ended up in the prize papers collection in the Admiralty papers in the National Archives. And what they show is that many of the consignments of these two ships were split between them. And that's allowed me, on discovering this material, to reconstruct quite a lot about the more perishable materials on the Santa Cristo di Castello, because I now know that they were split with consignments that were recorded and are in this great archive of documentary material in the National Archives for the other ship, for the Abraham Sacrifice. So it's a wonderful correlation of really rich documentary evidence, which is not always easy to come by, even for relatively recent historic wrecks, and this very rich archaeological site too, which contains all manner of interesting artifacts.
Explain to me how you figured out that one was associated with the other. How do you confirm the identity of a vessel like that?
Well, at the site itself, there were records, first of all, from 1667, 68, in Cornwall of ships that had come ashore, because, of course, there was great interest in salvage. And salvage was a manorial right, and the crown would also be interested, particularly in the more sort of lucrative wrecks. And as a result of that, there's quite a bit of documentary evidence, accounts of ships that came ashore, legal proceedings. And when the first divers began researching this site they'd found, they were easily able to narrow it down to a couple of clear possibilities. A very wonderful set of finds was made on the wreck, which sound a bit prosaic, but fantastic things. And these are merchants' weights, and they were stamped with the date of the regulating authority in Amsterdam who had issued them. And these weights have a final date of 1665-66, and the ship was made in that year, equipped in that year, wrecked in the following year. And that really pinned the whole thing down, because there was just no other possibility for a ship that looked like this, that we knew from the other artifacts, had come from Amsterdam. So that was the way that the ship was most definitively identified. And then in the documentary archive, it was literally the recording of the ship's name alongside that of the other ship and of the ship's captains as well. So I know that the name of the captain of the Santo Cristo di Castello, called Lorenzo, is the same man who's mentioned in the prize papers as the captain of the ship that split its cargo with the one that was taken as a prize. So everything all kind of adds together to give just about 100% certainty of the identification of the ship.
Now, you've dived that ship, haven't you? And you described your first glimpse of the ship as seeing the seabed sparkling with gold. Can you take me through the experience of that first dive? What did you see?
Well, what I decided to do, and this was in 2018, I'd known about this wreck because it had been discovered way back in 1969. But the accounts that we'd been told were that not only had it been quite extensively excavated, but also that treasure hunters had come to the site and they'd used explosives and they'd brought down some of the adjacent cliff and covered part of the wreck, blocking it, and meaning that the shingle and other material that normally shifted to and fro over the site was permanently burying it. And so we decided it really wasn't worth looking at. However, I changed my mind. And on one very fine sunny day, I snorkeled out from nearby Pelurian Cove, which is half an hour away, and swam into this little gully with these great cliffs looming above me called Poleglass, where I knew the wreck was. And as I came into it, I swam over the cascaded rock where the explosives had brought down the cliff. And just beyond that, I did start to see very eroded cannon poking out of the sediment. And as I came further along, this little inlet opened up. I always describe it as being like a cathedral space. And a lot of the artifacts we found, probably scrap metal, church artifacts. So there's a lot of candelabras and candlesticks and other things, which may have been taken from churches, Catholic churches in the 17th century. And because of all the religious material, it has this certain aura to it, this site. And as you go into it, and drop down to the seabed and look up, it has this kind of nave-like feel to it. But what was so exciting was seeing on one side of the site that the shingle had in fact shifted, revealing this concreted mat, I call it, which is caused by the ferrous material in iron ingots compacting into a corroded mass. And embedded within that were thousands of clothing pins, which looked like gold and shimmered in the sunlight, and other artifacts of brass, some of which were those church accoutrements I just mentioned. And so swimming down on this very sunny day, only 7 or 8 meters, onto the seabed and seeing this sort of shimmering bed was like coming down onto a great treasure wreck, which of course in archaeological and historical terms, it certainly is.
So you've given us a sense of what the cargo was and what survives, but I want to know if you have any sense of what has not survived. And I'm particularly wondering about whether what you find there is what has not been salvaged by previous generations, and if there are materials that just would not have survived the passage of time.
Absolutely. So one of the very important benefits of a rich documentary archival base that we have is that it lists for us exactly what you suggest, which is the very large quantity of material that a ship of this nature would have been carrying, which was perishable. And we know in this case that it included cinnamon and cloves and pepper and other spices. And this is really fascinating because, of course, those were the great riches brought at this time by the Dutch East India Company to Amsterdam from the Far East, from Indonesia and from India. And these were then being sold and transported out from Amsterdam on ships such as the Santa Cruz de Castello. So her greatest wealth in her cargo was undoubtedly in sacks and bales of very, very valuable spices, which were heading off to Spain and to Italy. And of course, all of those have gone. Interestingly, in some of the records of the salvage at the time, there's one record that laments the fact that quite a lot of this stuff had been brought ashore and was just rotting away because nobody really knew what to do with it. And it's poignant because that would have been the greatest loss in value in the ship. She was also carrying Russian hides, which is interesting. So these are Russian cow hides, which were also of great value. So there's a lot of material which would have constituted the greatest value and the greatest bulk of the cargo, which is gone. We know also that attempts were made at the time and subsequently to salvage the site. And this is before divers got involved on the scene. It's shallow enough that you could see probably the wreck on the seabed and you could put down tongs and even free dive down and bring things up. So undoubtedly, people would have got everything they possibly could out of it. But not all of it. And the quantity of material that remains at the site in some ways is quite surprisingly large. I mean, there's a large amount of quite valuable material, which of course people would have jumped to taking if they could have salvaged it at the time.
Is it true that there were some lost works of Rembrandt on board?
Yes. Now, this is the really amazing story. And this only has come to light very recently. In 2006, researchers in Genoa, looking at the archive of the Sauli family, discovered an extraordinary correspondence between Francesco Sauli, who was a wealthy member of the family at the time, and his agents in Amsterdam. And this dated from the time of the building of the Santa Cruz de Castello, because Sauli had a financial stake in that enterprise. And what the correspondence revealed was that he had instructed his agents and also the captain of the ship that was being built to get a painter called Rembrandt to produce two modelli, two smaller versions of paintings that he wanted put in his chapel in Genoa. And the name of the ship's captain was Lorenzo Viviano, which is the name that we already knew to have been the captain of the Santa Cruz de Castello. And so suddenly when I saw this, and I first came across this just a couple of years ago, and then began to research it further, it became clearer and clearer to me that these two paintings, which Rembrandt, after a lot of procrastination and wanting more money, and there's this sort of quote in the correspondence about how, as is usual with painters, he was unpredictable and somebody you can't rely on. eventually he did produce these paintings in 1667, and they were laden on the ship, and then they disappeared from history. And when I saw that, I realized that they must have been lost in this wreck on the coast of Cornwall. And that just, I was talking about this kind of mystical feeling of swimming into that site and imagining what lies there and what was once there, that there had been these two paintings, which even though they were modelli, would have been very high quality paintings. They would have been the size of, you know, easel paintings, and that they weren't the full size paintings that he would have wanted in his chapel. They would have been, you know, remarkable works of art and among really the great lost works of Rembrandt. So that's the only time I've ever had an experience like that on a wreck, of realizing there was something of that kind of extraordinary artistic and cultural interest that had once been on this ship as it came into this cove where I've been diving. I don't think we'll find any evidence of it, but it's always slightly possible there might be a little brass plaque with Rembrandt's name on it down there. But just knowing it was there adds hugely to the almost emotional power of a wreck like this.
Absolutely. And there's no chance that some enterprising Cornish diver took them up and put them in their house and in a few years' time will discover them.
I don't think so, because I think they wouldn't really have lasted very long underwater. It's slightly possible that Viviano, who we know survived the wreck, conceivably could have, at the last minute, taken these with him along with other valuable items, but fairly unlikely, because people don't tend to do that in shipwreck. They're really looking after themselves. So I think they would have gone down with the ship in 1667. Well, it's a very interesting time in Rembrandt's life, because he was somewhat in the doldrums, and it's possible that this commission by Sally, by this wealthy Genoese family, is something he might have seen as his salvation. You know, it could have led to many more similar commissions, church commissions in Italy. So undoubtedly its loss would have been a blow to him, but he was very resilient and carried on producing some of his greatest works subsequently.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Join us this month on Gone Medieval from History Hit. I'm Matt Lewis.
And I'm Eleanor Yonaga. This April, dive into our special mini-series.
With the help of leading experts, we're tracing the foundations of England by exploring the country's most powerful Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
We'll be looking at Northumbria, Mercia, and Wessex, as well as the rulers and their councils who helped shape a nation.
Make sure to get every episode by listening and following Gone Medieval from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me ask you about a couple of other wrecks you've been investigating. First of all, the Santo Antonio, the Saint Anthony. This is an earlier ship, 1527. What can you tell me about this ship, its journey, and who was on board?
So the Saint Anthony, the Santo Antonio, was a Portuguese carrack, and she wrecked in 1527 off Gunwalo. So we're not very far north of the site of the Santa Cristo de Castello. And in very, very shallow water, up against the great stretch of sands on the Lizard Peninsula that goes as far as Porthleven, several kilometers away. She was also a very richly appointed ship. She was owned by King John III of Portugal, and it's thought that she may have been carrying the dowry of his bride, Catherine, taking it from Lisbon to Antwerp, because Catherine was part of the Habsburg family based in the Netherlands. The ship was, like the Santa Cristo de Castello, extensively salvaged at the time. So in the same way, there's quite a lot of record of it from the period. But again, quite a lot of it remained in situ when it was rediscovered in as recently as 1981 by a local diver as a result of a bun-shaped copper ingot being discovered in the sand on the shoreline. And his subsequent diving on the site produced many more of those ingots and a silver ingot and lots of candlesticks and other artifacts. It's a frustrating site because it's in very shallow water, but it's often completely buried in sand. And as I was saying earlier, it's one of those sites which seems very unpromising at the outset because it's all spread out and strewn over, a result of a very destructive wrecking process. But unquestionably, there is a lot more there to be recovered. And my task as a licensee from Historic England, because this is a protected wreck, is to go out there and monitor it and survey it. And every time I go out, hope that more of it will be revealed and there will be some of these gullies on the wreck that might contain more extensive organic finds. It's a very, very interesting date because 1527 is very early. This is even before the Mary Rose was wrecked. And because it's Portuguese, this is a ship which is representative of the great Portuguese age of discovery. So really anything that can be found out about ships of that period has that extra significance at the time. And this is a time, of course, of all the great exploration of the Indies, Magellan going and circumnavigating the world in exactly this period. So there's a very rich historical backdrop to a wreck like this. And it's just a case of hoping as we go out there that more of it will be revealed in future.
And do you have a documentary trail for the St. Anthony?
Yes, we do, because of its significance as a royal ship and the probability that it's carrying the, or was carrying the dowry of John's queen-to-be. There is a lot of documentary material. Henry VIII got involved because it seems that John made entreaties to him to have the cargo returned to him. So there was a Court of Star Chamber convened, which was focused on the wreck. Whether or not any of the salvage material did actually make its way back to Portugal, we don't know. What we do know is that it did enrich several local people, as often happened with wrecks. And these include some of the best-known families in Cornwall, the Godolphins, for example, the St. Albans of St. Michael's Mount. So many of these landed families in Cornwall who were coastal benefited from wreck because often they could claim manorial right on wreck that was washed ashore. It's always been a significant factor in the Cornish economy at that level. And of course, and another aspect which really interests me with these wrecks too is that for local people, anything coming off a wreck, and we know this right way through to modern times, would be potentially of great economic significance as well. People often living, you know, hand to mouth from fishing and small scale agriculture. And there's a kind of wash of, if you like, of cultural material that reaches these shores from foreign parts as a result of artifacts and raw materials being taken up by not wealthy local people, but all manner of others who would have benefited from it. So in that sense, wrecks and wrecking has a significant part to play in the economics, if you like, of regions where ships were wrecked, such as that. And that's something that, you know, can be traced with more recent wrecks, especially in Cornwall.
You've also investigated another wreck, but this one is a ship of unknown origin, yet you can date it. So tell me about this wreck and how it was dated.
So the other wreck of potential Tudor date is now going further south on the Lizard Peninsula, so close to where the furthest southerly point of England, where it sticks out just beside Kynance Cove, which many people will have visited. And this is at a place called Rill Cove. And it's the most dramatic of all of these wrecks that we've talked about because it's set under huge towering cliffs, very difficult place to get to. It's a long way off from any place that you can get in from the shore to swim out to it. It's completely exposed to violent southwesterly storms. More often than not, diving at this site is completely inconceivable. Over the last 7 months, there's not been a single day where we could consider going out to it. It's been so bad. But this is a really amazing site. It was also found by local divers in the 60s and 1969. There was a kind of halcyon period of wreck discovery as people were learning to dive and getting out and exploring. So many of these wrecks that we're talking about were found initially at that time. And again, it was a very incoherent wreck. There was no hull or structural remains that suggested the appearance of the ship or anything. So in amongst the gullies and the sandy seafloor below this cliff, divers started finding hundreds and hundreds and then thousands of silver Spanish pieces of eight. So this is a true treasure wreck. Really fascinating because they all came from Spanish America or from Spain. So the majority of the coins were from Mexico, dating to the final two decades of the 16th century and just into the 17th century. There were also quite a large number from Potosi. Now, this was the fabled Silver Mountain in what's now Bolivia, which produced huge amounts of silver ore that was minted into coins for the Spanish. And there were also some coins that had been minted in Seville and other places in Spain itself. We have no idea of the name of the ship or where she was heading or why she had all these coins on board. It's a huge mystery. There were other artifacts found, a beautiful pair of navigational dividers, very similar to ones from the Mary Rose. There was a gunner's tally stick, a sort of a measurement stick, copper ingot. So again, probably a ship that had had other cargo on board that has perished or might have been salvaged at the time. Most of the coins were sold at the time, and this was in the 70s and 80s when it was still possible to do that. The divers who investigated that wreck and others along this coast were, for the most part, amateurs, and they were a very admirable group of people because they were really learning what they were doing at a time when there wasn't really very much guidance yet on how to do maritime archaeological investigation. They were often self-taught, very, very good historians. And in this case, the divers who studied this wreck did do quite a bit of research on the coins and found the attribution of many of them. And it's to be hoped in future that investigations there might produce more that could be numismatically studied. But even so, it's a really remarkable find for the period. And of all the wrecks that I've dived on around the Lizard Peninsula, this is the one that would probably count in most people's mind as a proper treasure wreck. And I've handled these coins, and they are the most amazing things. I mean, they're great heavy lumps of silver, very crudely embellished with the decoration that shows their origin and their denomination. And they're really absolutely redolent of that amazing period where the Spanish were engaged, unfortunately, in such destruction in the Americas, but were also finding and minting silver, which fueled their own activities back in Europe.
I'm really struck by the fact that all three of these wrecks were wrecked off the Lizard. Which is, I mean, it's a beautiful part of the world. If anyone wants to visit it, it's, you know, an absolutely gorgeous, own little microclimate. But apparently not good if you're a ship. So what is it? Is it those southwest storms you mentioned? What is it about the Lizard that means that we have so many wrecks there?
Yeah, so if you look at the map, it sticks out like the heel of a high-heeled boot into the sort of edge of the English Channel, beginning of the Atlantic. And the whole of the west side and the point itself is completely exposed, as you say, to the prevailing southwesterlies. And these are always there over the winter months, and some years, such as this year, they carry on beyond that. So ships traveling outward bound from, for example, Portsmouth or London or Amsterdam are going to travel into the teeth of these winds if they're unlucky. They'll try and avoid them, but very often it's those ships that are outward bound that then get blown back into the Lizard Peninsula. So they do their very best to avoid this happening, but it does. And as soon as they are being blown in that direction, there's very little a sailing ship do about it, really, because once they've sort of reached beyond a point of no return where they can't round the point and find safety back in Falmouth or Plymouth, then they're really doomed. And there are very few places along the whole stretch of the west side of the Lizard where you can find any kind of shelter. And so often the tragedy with these ships is that many of them were destroyed in huge gales, but not all of them. And there very often would have been people slowly but surely being blown inshore, knowing that there was nothing they could do about it, watching the shore get closer and closer, and then being wrecked against the cliff somewhere where there was just really very little chance of escape or survival. And so there's a lot of human tragedy in this. And then, of course, in the other direction, ships coming in from the Atlantic as well had just the same risk of the westerlies, which they were using to travel in the direction they wanted, instead blowing them a little bit too much to the northwest and into that coast. So it's a real trap for ships. And this carried on right the way through until the end of the Age of Sail and even beyond. I mean, there are steamship wrecks off the end of the Lizard from, there's one from the 1930s. So it's continued to be a danger. There is another feature of the Lizard, right off Lizard Point, which is the rather horrifying reefs that stick up like dragon's teeth off the end of the peninsula. And especially in fog, ships could think they'd cleared the point, but they hadn't. And they end up coming up against one of these rocks, which if you try navigating through them, are terrifying. They come and go with the tide and they are often just awash. And so it's a very, very dangerous place from that point of view as well.
So when you're dealing with these ships, these are sites not only of extraordinary remains and the hulls of ships, but they are graveyards, aren't they, quite often?
Yes, very, very often. And it's something which I think you're always conscious of as a diver. That thing I was talking about at the beginning of the heightened sensitivity and the intensity of diving and the high resolution of a wreck and all of that. Another aspect there is that you're dealing with places where people often died violently and suddenly and unexpectedly. And there's often an almost palpable sense of that with wrecks, where you're looking at what was left on the seabed at that very moment in time. And you're looking at the belongings and accoutrements of people as they had them at that moment in time, as they were using them. And I think that gives a real poignancy to wrecks. And you do approach them with a certain amount of respect as well, because, I mean, these are, even if there are no remains to be found, they are graves. Of course, some ships more recently are war graves and are protected for that reason as well. But I think it would be very unusual to find a diver who was not cognizant of this and didn't sometimes pause during the dive as you swim down into the blue depths and know that there is this wreck down there and that people died in the water that you're in now, who didn't pause and possibly have second thoughts and at least sort of feel, you know, a sense of respect and a little bit of the fear as well that people must have felt too. So yes, I'm always very aware of this on all the sites that we dive on.
Now, I'm a trustee of the Mary Rose, and you know, I think it's the most fantastic museum, and it's an incredible collection of objects from the Tudor period. And of course, we have the ship itself. And 40 plus years ago, when it was raised, that was the thing to do. I wanted to ask what maritime archaeology now says about shipwrecks. Do you consider raising them, or is it best to leave them in place?
The prevailing philosophy, which is a very practical one, is preservation in situ. So this is the, I would say, the main directive behind the way that most maritime archaeologists will approach sites, certainly in UK waters now. And the Mary Rose story really in many ways illustrates why that is the case, because on the one hand, obviously, you have the marvelous discovery and value of raising the hull and how that's enriched people's understanding of that period. And it's absolutely worth doing. But the expense and effort and the ongoing conservation issues, you know, it's an immense enterprise, isn't it? And even just raising a few timbers, you do have a responsibility to do the same thing with them and go through the same process. And so the issue really is, it's not just simply a matter of expense and conservation. It's a matter of where they're kept and where they're preserved. There is no National Museum of Shipwreck Archaeology in Britain. There's no one place to which finds that might come from wrecks can be taken. But it's also actually a procedural issue to do with archaeology, that nowadays we can record things so well underwater. The techniques of recording are so much more sophisticated and exacting than they used to be, that the point of actually raising material is reduced as well. There's an argument in that sense for devoting more effort to finding ways of remotely surveying and remotely recording objects in situ. The conundrum arises with wrecks that are exposed to the elements or to illicit salvage, where there's the danger if there are materials exposed and readily removable, that they might be damaged or lost. And those sort of issues, I think, just have to be addressed site by site. All of the wrecks that I have dived on that are protected sites, in theory, are exposed to looting. Wrecks that are known to have had silver coins on, such as the Rilco wreck. I think that's a sort of fairly rare occurrence nowadays, but it was an issue back in the time when these sites were first being discovered in the 60s and 70s. It's a kind of ethical issue in archaeology, isn't it, as to whether to leave things as they are. And it's not just for future generations. I find that a bit dispiriting myself. You know, I think that I want us to know what we can about archaeology. I don't want us to be leaving it for sites to be sort of excavated in future when they can preserve things better. I have a slightly more positive attitude, which is that, you know, yes, we can leave things in situ, but let's do everything we can to record them as well as we can. And, you know, even advances in photography, like underwater photography, cinematography, in the time that I've been a diver, have moved us really from very limited ability to do imagery to the time from 5-10 years ago where almost every diver goes down with a pretty good camera now. And so there are masses of imagery being produced for some of the wrecks that we've been talking about. And much of the work that we've been doing really has been capturing that imagery and recording those sites. And I think that's probably the biggest change in my lifetime in what's been possible underwater in terms of techniques. And so that sort of opens up a way of experiencing wrecks that doesn't require you to have to raise them and to lift the material, because you get such wonderful impressions of them from underwater photographs and moving images.
You have an investigation upcoming, don't you, of a fabled wreck. Tell me about that.
Well, there is one of the fabled wrecks of the Lizard Peninsula, again, is one which divers have known for decades as the Earl of Cumberland's Prize. And this is one of the ships captured by George Clifford, Earl of Cumberland, on one of his expeditions against the Spanish to the Azores and further afield into the Caribbean as well. And in 1589, one of the ships that he captured, which is said to have been laden with stolen silver, wrecked in Mounts Bay. We don't know where, but it's very possible that it would have wrecked against the coast of the Lizard, because that's where ships are blown into. And there is one site in particular, one cannon wreck in very shallow water, which we think might conceivably be this wreck. It might not be, but it's worth investigation. And that's all I can say about it at the moment. But it is the one big prize that has yet to be discovered in wrecks of this date range, in Mounts Bay anyway, off the Lizard. So watch this space and we'll see what arises if we're able to get out and if the site is uncovered and we can do some recording of it.
How very exciting. Well, just to finish then, you have spent your life, or the majority of your life, leading expeditions all over the world. What is it about this that continues to fascinate you? And why do you think shipwrecks hold such a special place in the popular imagination?
I think shipwrecks are very beguiling sites because of that resolution, again, the extreme precision with which you can know about the event that caused the wreck and what the people on the ship and what they were doing. It's almost as if, as a phenomenon, a wreck draws space and time into it. And when I was writing my book, I really felt this with the wrecks that I'd chosen to focus on, that you can do a wreck book as a catalogue of sites, as you can do any other archaeological book. But what makes it work is to see those sites as a springboard for drawing in history and everything else going on at the time. And wrecks are very much like that, because they have this great precision, but in a way, that very precision allows you this huge latitude of imagination and of sort of historical breadth in the way that you look at. You can spring from wrecks talking about the people on the ships, the cargo, the artifacts, how they were made. You can, as in the case of the Mary Rose, you can talk about the big figures of history like Henry VIII, you know, who stepped on board the Mary Rose. You can talk about the common sailors and people who are otherwise unrecorded in history. So it's this great, powerful nexus of history. And I think that's what continually gives wrecks of any period and in any place great interest. And I would say that that goes as far forward as I try to demonstrate in the book as the 19th and 20th century as well, when we think everything is sort of adequately documented and recorded. But the nature of wrecks transcends that, because there's a kind of power to the imagination in archaeological sites, even if they are for periods such as the Second World War where we have such a lot of documentary evidence and that are almost within living memory as well, that wrecks still have a great deal of emotive power for us. But for me, I think I discovered when I was a child a fascination with underwater discovery. I grew up at the time of Captain Cousteau. It just hooked me. And I feel very fortunate that I was able to make a career of it, both in terms of shipwreck archaeology and also in terms of the way that I've been able to present it, both in fiction and now in nonfiction as well. And it's a bit addictive. So, I mean, once you've made a few discoveries, you want to go out and make more. And, you know, it's the next wreck just behind the next, you know, reef that there is to be discovered. And there's always more to be found. And I think that the other thing is that really came across to me in writing the book is that you always think you know more or less things. But when you then delve into the sites that you think you know really well, you just find out such a lot more. And as you evolve, as you know, as a historian or as an archaeologist, your perspectives change and alter. And I know that now I see things through a lens very different to the one I might have had when I started my career. And that means that the whole process of looking at wrecks, even ones that have already been found, is an endlessly exciting and interesting process. And there's always more history to be drawn into it and more stories to be told.
Well, you have shared your passion very convincingly with us. And anyone who has caught that must pick up a copy of your wonderful book, A History of the World in 12 Shipwrecks, to carry on the adventure with you. David, thank you so much for your time. This has been really fabulous.
Thank you very much.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, and also to my researcher, Alice Smith, my producer, Rob Weinberg, and Ella Blacksall, who edited this episode. We're always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, @notjusttudors. And do remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age, a house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.